You're listening to the ISACA podcast. I'm your host, Safia Kazi, and in this From Page to Podcast series episode, Lisa Villanueva, a technical research manager at ISACA, is interviewing Mark Thomas, a COBIT trainer and president of Scout Consulting. In this episode, they'll be discussing how to use COBIT to govern and manage third-party risk. So Lisa, please take it away.
Thank you, Safia, and thank you, Mark, for joining us today to discuss COBIT and third-party management. Mark, you've been evangelizing COBIT around the world, so we're grateful to have you here to share your special insights into how organizations are governing and managing vendor risk globally. I wanted to pick your brain today about some of the things you're seeing across industries. How are they governing and managing vendor risk using COBIT? Let's dive right in.
Great. We'll do it, Lisa. Thank you very much. As you said, I've had a fortunate opportunity to work around the world in a lot of different industries, finance, services, manufacturing, insurance, and so on. And of course, you know I'm a huge fan of COBIT, and I get opportunities to see a lot of organizations and how they operate when it comes to putting practices in place to help them govern and manage third-party risk. But as we all know, just having one framework may not be enough. So what I want to do is talk to you a little bit today about how using frameworks such as COBIT, particularly the latest release, COBIT 2019, to govern and manage practices based on COBIT when it comes to managing third-party risk. Now, there's no such thing as an enterprise that functions without suppliers, and there's really no such thing as an enterprise that does not assess risk.
Absolutely.
The difference here between a successful organization and one that is not is how they govern and manage their risk. And that's not just vendor risk, that's multiple areas of risk. But in today's environment, what I'm seeing is suppliers are a key aspect to not only the success of the delivery of IT services, really looking at the overall risk profile. So I can picture this corporate security or risk manager, and they're sitting back looking at their dashboard, and they have traditional performance and risk indicators, and they're all showing this green status. So they're very happy. But in the background, they don't realize this. Their vendors are full of vulnerabilities. They're experiencing massive incidents that are soon going to affect their operations. So that's what I want to touch on, the application of frameworks such as COBIT, to help you select and prioritize scenarios, specifically vendor or third-party risk scenarios. Link those to your risk management process and your operations. Recognize where you can find good practices. Really help you mitigate a lot of those third-party risks.
So, Mark, you know, you talk about those dashboards and how sometimes they can be deceiving. So that gets me to thinking a little bit about what are the key challenges organizations face managing their vendor and supplier risk?
That's great, because you know, your vendor, third parties and suppliers, whatever you call them in your organization, you can't control how a vendor actually operates. So I've seen that it's not always the vendors who are the risk, but sometimes it's the manner in which an organization sets up their contract. For example, they can underpin my service level agreements. I had an organization I was a CIO of. We could not meet multiple service level agreements that I had with my customers. But here's what's interesting is we wanted to blame our vendors for everything. Of course, the vendors were part of this, but they were doing exactly what I contracted them to do. So it's interesting that we see that. So a lot of times in our market, we say, well, make sure you watch your vendors, make sure you watch your vendors. But if you don't put them under the right contract, they may be doing exactly what you told them to do. So I've seen that there are several other challenges you might run into out there. For example, inadequate performance of an outsourcer or a vendor in, say, a large-scale, long-term outsourcing arrangement. You may have unreasonable terms in this with suppliers with your contracts. You may have inadequate support. Of course, non-compliance with things like software licensing agreements, the inability to transfer to alternative suppliers. You may be hooked to a supplier and can't get out of that agreement. Hopefully, I'll get a chance to tell you a story about that here in just a little bit. You may purchase IT services, and they may result in the inability to integrate my in-house services, so they're not congruent services that I'm providing for my customers and my consumers. And of course, having an SLA or a contract that's inadequate, and we can't enforce that because, again, it's affecting my service level agreements. So I think there are a lot of things out there, and I want to jump clearly into COVID in a few minutes, but you know, some things that I've seen out there that can help us with some of those challenges within the COVID, especially the latest release of COVID 2019, you know, you can look at things like the risk scenarios we have. In risk scenarios, you'll find those under what we call the design guide. And we have design factor number 3, which is a risk profile. And in that risk profile, it does mention in there that we have non-performing or incidents related to third parties. So as I go through all those challenges, you have to really sit back and consider how you could remediate some of these challenges. And the trick is to get all the stakeholders involved when it comes to realizing the value from enterprise information and technology.
Do you often see that identifying stakeholders is one of those challenges as well? Who are some of the key stakeholders, particularly those organizations tend to forget in the initial stages?
Yeah, and that's a really good question, because the first thing I want to do is say where I would find is some examples of these stakeholders. So the first thing I would do, I would look at the Governance and Management Objectives Guide. There are 40 objectives out there, and they relate to a process. And the process that I would focus on for this, several processes when it comes to third-party and vendor management, would be things like APO 10, which is managed vendors, of course, along with EDM 03, ensure risk optimization. You've got APO 12, managed risk, DSS 04, managed continuity. So, of course, you can select a lot of processes out there, but I would go out to that guide, because in that guide, under each of those objectives, it does talk about stakeholders, and there are RACI charts in there that can help me look at who might be, say, responsible or accountable for certain practices. And there's another great document out there from COBIT. It goes back to the COBIT 5 series, and we call that Vendor Management Using COBIT 5. It's a great publication and also indicates potential stakeholders. Now, if I go take a look, what I would find is there are some key stakeholders that should be involved throughout the entire process. I would say things like IT operations and IT service owners, business relationship managers and service level managers. Of course, you can't forget information, cybersecurity, internal audit, compliance, legal and your risk organizations. And there are many applicable governing bodies that might also have a say or some guidance in how we might design our vendor program. Those would be things like the board of directors. You may have an architecture committee, multiple steering committees. And of course, do not forget the procurement function when it comes to this. So there are many different stakeholders, and they should be engaged in different ways throughout the entire process of the vendor management program.
You know, those are all really great insights, and it really gets me thinking as we talk about the different stakeholders, the entire life cycle for vendor risk management. Can you share the steps that you've seen successful organizations take in their vendor risk management process?
You got it. And this is really a key thing, to have some governance and really have some formal management practices over the process itself. So understanding that's key. So what I would say is, number one, you have to be able to set this up and plan this. And when I talk about this is identify clear requirements that are needed from each one of the stakeholders. Of course, we go through a call for tender and evaluation and the shortlist kind of piece of that. So having your requirements understood is very key first. Then you go through your due diligence and your selection. Of course, that's when you evaluate your vendors based on whatever factors you use as an organization. And you might be able to weight those depending on what's most important to you. You go into contract negotiation. This is very key. You have to understand what this contract says, because you have to really define what the deliverables are, service levels, the metrics, the costs, and of course, the legal parts of that. And I'll talk a little bit more about some of those here in just a little bit for you. But once you get that contract in place, you have ongoing monitoring and maybe even change management of that relationship and contract. So you have to transition in. You have as the delivery and the relationship, and you start to see a lot of relationship management piece. But one thing that most people forget to do is they look at their termination and even the contingency planning for the life of that contract. So things like operational phase out, and of course, the transition of knowledge and the transition of data and the operations to maybe a new vendor. And sometimes that can be a sticky subject. So I have a friend right now who's in a situation. He has a software as a service provider. He was an early adopter of software as a service. They entered into this contract. Really, I would say they didn't think about all their full requirements. This SaaS vendor was purchased by a large organization. My friend and his organization reached out and said, hey, we're ready to move out and we're going to go to another vendor. Well, that SaaS provider said, well, I'm not sure how you're planning on doing that because we own the data. The software provider actually owned their data. On top of that, the contract or the provider said, hey, look, we're not going to spend a lot of money. I'm moving you out of our operations and moving you to a competitor. Plus, we have proprietary APIs and these types of things. So this organization is hijacked. They can't leave this organization. So they're in a court battle right now. But my whole point here is this. During your negotiations, if you don't ask for it, that vendor may not provide it, right? For example, ask for things like access policies, security policies and arrangement, the right to audit, those types of things that might be out there. So you see a lot of things out there, and I will say that your biggest vulnerability is during that contract negotiation.
It's very, very interesting what you were saying, and it gets me thinking a little bit about, you know, just ownership in general. When you said that the contract and the failure to negotiate those appropriately could result in some catastrophic situations, such as the software provider owning their data, should organizations expect their control ownership to shift or change as a result of a strategic or tactical decision to outsource or leverage a third-party service?
Yes. When you mention third-party controls, right, I have to refer back to what we call the three lines of defense. And this is something that we've espoused at ISACA, as well as the risk and security industry. And this is where the first line owns controls. The second line is the risk function. And the third line is audit. If we wait for audit to catch something, that's like blaming the goalie for losing the soccer match, right? So we have to make sure the controls are at the first line of defense. Now, to answer your question directly, it's yes and no, right? So the first line of defense may be my control owners. However, they might not be the same person or the same role as the risk owner. So I recently saw a major global organization. This was a client of mine. They decided to outsource services to a third party. They'd done this quite some time ago. It was a strategic decision so the company could really focus on their core business. Now, after very weak requirements and vendor selection, they handed everything off to their corporate procurement department and let them finish the rest. This was a massive mistake because not all stakeholders were involved and they really didn't understand who owned those controls. So they ran into, for example, their service level agreements with their customers were not being met because the vendor was non-performing. There were no procedural, there were no legal repercussions for these identified in their contract. And finally, one of the worst nightmares actually happened. Their vendor had a data breach and this made national news. And this resulted in an emergency on behalf of my client who was scrambling to figure out what went wrong because they hadn't identified who owned these controls. And that should be driven by the risk ownership. So my solution would be this. Number one, identify your risk scenarios. It's not necessarily about the controls. You may have controls in place that already are helping you with some of your scenarios. So these scenarios include things like risks to your vendor selection process, risks to contract development, vendor requirements, and the governance of your vendor program. So you identify these scenarios, you determine your risk ownership, and risk owners are then accountable for determining the proper risk response based on the likelihood and the impact of that scenario. Therefore, owners, they can choose to accept that risk. They can avoid it, they can transfer it, or they can mitigate those risks. And when we mitigate, we're putting controls in place to reduce the likelihood and impact of that scenario happening. So now on to mitigation a little bit more. This is the effort that will bring that residual risk of that event down within the risk appetite levels that are set by a governing body. So those are therefore the controls that must be monitored, and you have to have key risk indicators for each one of those. Those controls can be things like setting up appropriate monitoring and reporting, evaluation of vendor internal controls. Here's a big one that we're seeing a lot of right now in the industry, hardware disposal stipulations, and of course, encryption, information access policies, and those types of things. So as I mentioned before, I like to look into COBIT to help here. right? We have what we call the design guide within the latest release in 2019. There's one of the design factors called factor 3, which is risk profile. And we have factor number 8, which is the sourcing model, right? We can use those to help us look at potential risks when we're setting up our vendors. We also have a really good document, I mentioned this before, is vendor management using COVID-5. Now, some people might say, well, that's COVID-5. Well, this links nicely with COVID-2019. It has example threats, and it has example mitigating actions for us for every one of those threats or those risk scenarios we have. And of course, within the governance and management objectives guide within COVID-2019, we have practices and activities that are identified that can help assist in determining your controls, and as well as a RACI chart that can help you determine your control ownership.
Excellent, excellent. And, you know, you talked about transfer of risk, and that really reminds me of how, you know, organizations likely have different drivers for why they engage with suppliers or enter into outsourcing arrangements in general. How do these different drivers play into the design of an optimal vendor management program?
Yeah, so mentioning transfer risk, and that's a great segue into one of the things I wanted to talk about next is when we mention transfer risk, most people just say, oh, we just go out and get insurance. Well, insurance is transferring financial risk, right? And so if I transfer my risk to an insurance provider and I break the law, my insurance provider is not going to jail for me. So one of the things we may do to share or transfer risk is to outsource. For example, say a managed service provider. I was a CIO for a large managed service provider in North America. And we used that actually as a sales gambit. We said, hey, are you having a hard time managing risk? Transfer it over to us. And we are well suited to handle those risks. So we do need third parties. Why do we need third parties? Well, we can focus on our core business and we select those vendors who are good at what they do. And those arrangements, they can range from strategic arrangements such as complete process outsourcing down to tactical and operational arrangements such as, say, maintenance agreements. But we can also outsource because we may have capacity constraints, we may have specific knowledge needs, and of course, as I mentioned before, to transfer our risk to somebody who can do that better than us. But there should always be cost-benefit analysis along with this risk analysis. So every organization has different reasons why they outsource. We may be an organization that's on offense or defense. For example, if I'm on offense, my board is saying, grow, gain market share. Or if we're on defense, we're in more of a cost savings type of mode. We may have different risk profiles, and that may be based on the industry or the type of business we're in. We have different sourcing strategies. Do we go to the cloud or not? I do have organizations that I'm aware of that are saying, do not go to the cloud, and other organizations, such as some states in North America, who are saying, go to cloud first. We may have different threat landscapes, different compliance requirements, and so on. I would again turn to COVID-2019 here. One of my favorite parts of this latest release is what we call the design factors. These can help you design a tailored governance system which can include your vendor governance program. But again, everybody has different ways which we look at our organizational strategy and risks. You do not want a cookie cutter type of solution. You want to make sure that you create a solution that is specific to your organization. And I think COVID helps us do that with the latest release.
Absolutely, absolutely. You've given us good information about how the COVID framework can assist decision makers, whether it be in you sharing the challenges that you've seen organizations face, some of the work you've done globally, the importance of contract negotiations, the identification of stakeholders and the like. Some of our listeners may not know where to start or may have developed their vendor management programs following other frameworks or standards. What would you say to those listeners who may think adopting COBIT would require them to start from scratch?
I will tell you that in most organizations, and I've experienced this as well as probably most of our listeners, is we get overwhelmed with frameworks. You know, I call it framework exhaustion. But what I would suggest that people do is really honestly look at COBIT as a framework to govern and manage other frameworks, because you can't be successful in an organization today with just one. So COBIT is designed to be open and flexible and really meets the needs of many different types of enterprises. So what I would first do is I would go to what we call the Governance and Management Objectives Guide. You can download that right off the ISACA site. Actually, you can download all of the current publications that are currently available out there. But in that guide for each governance and management objective, remember, one of those is called managed vendors. One of those is called managed risk. So for each one of those, we have what's called related guidance. And that related guidance is the industry-related standards, frameworks, and bodies of knowledge that are all applicable when you're getting into a vendor management program. And there are references out there such as NIST publications, multiple ISO standards. We have ISO 31000, we have ISO 27000 series, we have SANS Top 20, what we call the CIS Critical Security Controls today, and of course, a lot of great information out there when it comes to benchmarking yourself and looking at the overall maturity of your program. So I would say use multiple frameworks, but COBIT as a framework to help you govern and manage those frameworks, and use those references to help you kind of remove that framework exhaustion that you might be experiencing.
Thank you so much, Mark. I really appreciate you taking the time to provide our listeners with insights and practical guidance on how enterprises are using COBIT on the ground. Where can we find you on social media?
So I do post a lot about these types of subjects out on Twitter. Twitter, I'm at @escout1. That's ESCOUTE1. You can also find me on markthomasonline.com, and I'll post a lot of blogs and a lot of videos about subjects just like this that I think are informative, and they really give you what I call the street view of how you handle a lot of these issues that we're talking about today.
Thanks, Mark. Safia, I'll turn it back to you now so you can tell the listeners how they can learn more on this topic.
Thanks, Lisa and Mark. And that's all we have time for in this episode of the ISACA podcast. But you can hear more from Mark on using COBIT to govern and manage third-party risk by attending ISACA's November 14th webinar, Managing Third-Party Risk with COBIT. If you're listening to this podcast after November 14th, you can access an archived version of it on the webinars page of the ISACA website. And we'll be doing more podcasts with Mark in the future, so be sure to subscribe to the ISACA podcast so you don't miss an episode.